Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Good morning or afternoon slash evening, depending on when you're tuning in. We've got a great interview with Dr. Ian Bremmer about his new book, The Power of Crisis, How Three Threats and Our Response Will Change the World. Before we get into that, I'd like to shout out a couple of things. Number one, if you'd like to support the show as we grow and expand, you can click the subscribe and support show link at the top of the show notes on your podcast player, or you can go to realignment.supercast.com. We've got three different tiers of support. Now that we've expanded to three episodes a week, we're excited to actually start dropping our subscriber-only Q&A segments with me and Sagar starting next week. Subscribers who are already tuning into that, you can go to the Supercast website to submit additional questions and see the ones that have been submitted already. Number two, right under the subscribe to the Supercast link, you'll find another link to our weekly Substack, which we send out on Fridays. We'd love for you to go subscribe to that, or you could go to realignment.substack.com. We've got lots of interesting bonus features and content for folks who want to dive deeper into the show and learn more about what we're up to at The Realignment. Number three, and finally, we speak to a lot of authors and talk about a lot of books on the show. So if you want to purchase anything we discuss, you can go to our online bookshop, which is also linked in the show notes. It's bookshop.org. You support a local independent bookseller, and we get 10% of that actual purchase, which is really great. Now back to today's episode. Ian and I are focused on the question of whether a crisis like COVID-19, the war in Ukraine, or any other big black swan event that could define the 2020s can shake our political system out of what I think we could lightly call a funk slash bit of stagnation if you're into Tyler Cowen, or decadence if you're more of a Ross Douthat fan. We'd love to hear what you think, so you can email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com or simply comment or reply to our Substack. I know we sent a lot of links out this episode, so definitely check the show notes or the Substack for anything you may have missed. With all that, a huge thanks to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Here's the episode. Ian Bremmer, welcome to The Realignment.
Happy to join you.
It's interesting. The book is called The Power of Crisis, but we've just gone through a 2-year plus crisis where I don't feel as if we're any closer to an international disease preparedness body or climate action. What went wrong given the framework you've set up here?
Climate action, I think we are absolutely a lot closer than we have been, but we'll start with the pandemic where I think you're right. And what went wrong? Well, frankly, I mean, as much as I hate to say this, in many ways, the crisis wasn't big enough. Because at the beginning, when we were scared and we had no idea what we were dealing with, the United States came together, right? I mean, you'll remember that Fauci was lionized, listened to every evening. What should we do? You know, he's the guy with the white jacket, going to pay attention. And also the economic response in the U.S. was so quick. It was so robust. It wasn't just the business leaders and the bankers that were bailed out. It was the average American. And that led to a V-shaped recovery in the United States, which pretty good deal for a crisis that could have been a depression. In the U.S., the scale of this immense and sudden lockdown was pretty staggering. And everyone out there said, how am I going to work? How am I going to have a restaurant? How am I going to have, you know, anything, you know, a car repair store? What do I do? And that was, you know, even in a country that it was as divided as Trump versus Pelosi, both sides came together and got that done. But in relatively short order, when we suddenly had these wonderful vaccines that were available in the middle of an election cycle, Americans started getting less worried. Well, maybe it's just old people. Maybe it's just people that are already sick. Maybe I don't need to pay attention as much. And suddenly it gets politicized. It becomes red versus blue. And the United States, you know, ends up more divided on the back of the pandemic than it was coming in. Europe, that wasn't true. The Europeans actually did take advantage of this crisis. And frankly, even though a million people died in Europe, just like the United States, the EU came out of the pandemic stronger because of the pandemic. They used it to redistribute wealth from the wealthy countries to the poor countries. They used it to build EU capabilities, to actually acquire and distribute vaccines across the entire European Union. So different than the Eurozone crisis when the Germans are blaming the Greeks for being lazy and shiftless and maybe we should kick them out of the EU. That wasn't what was happening here. It was we're all Europeans together. We have to respond to this crisis together. But that's the way we look at it. And I think even in China, which did such a great job in the early months after they admitted that there was a pandemic. Of course, they lied about it originally, even to their own people. But they were so confident in their ability to lock down and track and trace while the Americans and Europeans were losing hundreds of thousands of men and women, that the Chinese didn't learn any lessons. And they were frankly caught with their pants down as the pandemic changed. As the variants changed and became much more transmissible, while the Chinese vaccines weren't capable of responding to that. The Chinese were lazy about vaccinating their own elderly population. They didn't think it was necessary because they could lock down and they could trace. And now, as a consequence, they have much more case explosion with these new Omicron variants, and you see what it's doing to their economy. So, I mean, that's a little bit of a kind of around the world on what we did and didn't do to take advantage of this horrible 2+ year pandemic, which we are not through by any means.
So I'd love to hear your definition of what a crisis actually is, because even in the way I phrased the first question, I identified disease preparedness and climate action as crises. These are some of the things you talk about in the book, but obviously we've got a balanced listenership here between left and right. The right part of my audience is already mad at me because they would say climate change is not a crisis, if it's even real. And they would also say that me talking about international health bodies, that's basically reference to global governance, which is something the right isn't comfortable with. So how do you define crises in a way that doesn't just fall into a left-wing crisis or a right-wing crisis? Let's say that.
Well, first, I think that's unfair to your right-wing audience to say that they don't believe that climate change is real. That's not true anymore. I mean, I think that you've got 195 countries around the world with very different governments that all accept that we have 1.2 degrees centigrade of global warming already, and that it's not because of, you know, cycles in nature. It's because of human beings pumping carbon and methane into the atmosphere. Now, there are a lot of people that disagree about what we should do in response to that and how much of a crisis it should be. And should we actually, you know, focus on nuclear energy, and is coal okay? And do you want to take away a lot of jobs just to, you know, sort of for what's 30 or 50 years out? I mean, there are a lot of reasons why people respond to climate change differently, but the world believes it's a crisis. Now, the pandemic is a very different story because the left defined the pandemic consistently as a crisis, a health crisis that required vigorous masking, that required vigilant quarantines and lockdowns. And the right, first of all, strongly opposed mandates and thought this was a matter of individual choice on the basis of how at risk you personally were or were not, and were willing to put at risk your families, the people close to you. But also, from the beginning, we're more focused on things like what kind of damage are we doing to young people by keeping them out of school for a year or two? What kind of damage are we doing to poor people by locking them out of the work that they feel like they need to do or else, right? And how much depression are you causing? How much more type 2 diabetes are you going to get? I mean, all of these sorts of things. So I think that in this case, the pandemic is a crisis that was defined very differently by different people politically. And you get at a very critical point here, Marshall, which is that you're much more likely to respond effectively to a crisis when we all agree on what the crisis is. Now, climate change 30 years ago was mostly the domain of activists on the left and a small number of people around the world who were disenfranchised and poor and living in places that were already getting affected by small changes. The Bangladesh, it's saving the whales, it's hugging the trees. And the average American didn't care very much about that. But today in 2022, it's about Louisiana and California, and it's about Australia and Italy. And I mean, my God, it's everywhere. And so not only do we all agree on what the problem is, but every day the news that we get reinforces our priors, confirms just how much of a global problem this really is and that we have to do something about it. By the way, those two characteristics are very similar to the way the Russia-Ukraine crisis has played out. When Putin on February 24th invaded Ukraine, everyone in the West, the United States and its NATO allies, agreed that Putin was the problem, that Putin was the criminal, that the Ukrainians were innocents. And every day that that war went on, some 100 days plus at this point, you had your priors confirmed. You saw the war crimes being committed in Bucha and Melitopol. You saw the courageousness of the Ukrainians, you know, this underdog, this, you know, Sweet 16 Cinderella story as they were fighting, you know, against Putin. And so it was exactly the kind of crisis that you would expect would create opportunities for leadership, opportunities to actually think differently about how we relate to the world around us. Very different than the pandemic in that way.
You know, it's funny. I actually unironically appreciate your correction on me sort of defining down the audience, because what I was really trying to get at is, yes, let's just assume that people agree that, you know, climate change is real. I guess what I'm more getting at is, for me, the debate isn't climate change, yes or no. The debate is, okay, climate change is real. Carbon tax, yes or no. Okay, yes. If you're in France, climate change is real, but yellow vest protests over increasing the price of gas. That's obviously a generationally defining issue there. So I guess my question for you would be, at what point do you see climate change transcending just consensus as this is real to actually this is worth sacrifice, especially when you're coming to right-leaning voters? Because I just would not posit that those Louisianan voters who are suffering impacts of climate change are going to be sending their senator, like say Senator Kennedy, to vote for a big carbon tax or a redistribution system in that.
Oh, way. God. I mean, Marshall, it's worse than that. I mean, you know, the progressives on the left who talk about a Green New Deal, they're not talking about a Green Marshall Plan. They're not talking about willingness to spend American taxpayer money to actually try to make the planet better for the people that are really suffering, like in India, where they've for the last 3 months had 110, 115, 120 degree weather where you can't even work outside after 10 a.m. Over 1 billion Indians living under those conditions with birds literally falling dead out of the sky because they're incredibly poor. And we're the ones that have been pumping the carbon and benefiting from it as a wealthy country. I don't see the woke left in the United States saying, let's treat those Indians as human beings like Americans are. My God. So, I mean, if you really want to answer your question, it's not about when do we convince right-wingers that they need to sacrifice for everyone in the United States? When do you convince Americans that everyone's a human being? That's the question. It's a much deeper question. And I'm actually pretty optimistic about it.
Wait, quick follow-up, just because this speaks to your broader work. Your previous book was Us Versus Them. Yep. It's about globalism. It seems like you just kind of made a globalist argument, right? This very like 1990s, you know, think, act locally, think globally. What's the difference in what you just articulated and that previous vision?
Huge difference, Marshall. I made an anti-globalist argument. The globalist argument is not globalization. The globalist argument is a relatively small number of elites who benefited massively from profit taking off of free trade, off of the United States and allies providing global security, off of promoting democracy around the world, and argue that everyone will be better off if you just let us keep doing that. Mm. And that didn't happen. What happened was you created a global middle class, but you had a whole bunch of middle classes in the United States and in Europe and increasingly in developing countries too, that said, we're not benefiting. We're really angry. We're not going to support your ideological globalism going forward. No. The argument I just made isn't about globalism. It's about humanity. It's saying that I think just because I happen to be born in the United States, that doesn't make me more important as a citizen, as someone who was born outside the United States. I truly don't believe. I think that nationalism is one of the most insidious forms of differentiation, of forced differentiation and dehumanization that we have on the planet today. I think it's as bad as racism because it allows us to neglect billions and billions of people on the planet today. And, you know, we can't wall ourselves off from each other. And it's debilitating morally. It's debilitating spiritually. It's debilitating emotionally to pretend that somehow you are other and better just because of some random incidence of luck at birth. But what I'm arguing on climate is that the impact has become so great that a disparate group of people all over the world, and it started off mostly with young people because they see that they're going to be the ones inheriting a planet that will be in much worse shape because of decisions that have been made by people before they were born. They're angry about it, and they're making demands of corporations and of banks and of some of their governments and some of their local leaders, saying, we want you to do things differently. And what I see happening is a massive shift in trillions of dollars of investments away from thermal coal, and then away from fossil fuels more broadly towards renewables. So much so that we are now seeing that at scale, whether it's electric vehicles and the supply chain for them, or it's advanced nuclear power, or it's solar and wind, that we are going to move our global energy footprint within a generation. A majority of the world's energy will no longer come from fossil fuels, from oil and gas and coal. And that is extraordinary. That's an amazing thing that's been done, even though the US and the Chinese don't trust each other, even though red and blue states don't trust each other, even though we don't all agree on how these resources should be spent, we've already kind of like done enough that we can see where the outcome is gonna go. More needs to be done because the difference between 1.5 and 2.5 degrees centigrade is tens of trillions of dollars and hundreds of millions of lives hanging in the balance. So I'm not suggesting that it's over, but I am suggesting that we are taking advantage of this crisis finally. And that's a really big deal. It's a really hopeful message in a way that we haven't taken advantage of the pandemic, the question, Marshall, that you asked me right at the beginning.
You know, I'm fascinated by your discourse on nationalism. So you were really speaking on an individual level. I'm curious how you think a politician, let's say, especially an elected politician, how should they think about that dynamic? Because it's one thing to say that I, Marshall, or you, Ian, as individuals, shouldn't think of ourselves as more deserving, more important than, let's say, a Bangladeshi or a Maldivian. But if, let's say, you're a senator, you know, like J.D. Vance is probably going to be the senator from Ohio. He spends a lot of time talking about how a problem of this globalism era was that American politicians thought their responsibility was not to people in their hometowns rather than people abroad. So how should a politician?
Well, he's lying. He's lying. Because what happened was not that those politicians were responsible for people outside the US. Instead, they were responsible to a small number of Americans that were paying for their campaigns and that captured the regulatory environment. And J.D. Vance has some of those people too. So, I mean, be very careful about J.D. Vance talking about technology and which companies he'll go after and which ones he won't on the basis of the ones that ended up funding him and allowing him to become who J.D. Vance is today. I think that's a really big deal. So if you want to know who somebody is, the first thing you should do is figure out who's paying them. And I think that one of the biggest problems we have in U.S. politics today is that it is the democratic system that is most influenced by money, by most influenced by special interests. Our campaigns are relentless. They are long. They are more expensive by a large margin than any other campaigns in the world. And that means that our politicians frequently serve the interests of those special, of those donors at the expense of their own constituents. And I think that, you know, as much as the Make America Great Again types will tell you that's not true, look at what Trump did in terms of his cabinet. Look at the billionaires and the special interests that were represented there. Look at the tax policy that was doled out under Trump. Look at the benefits for those that own real estate, for example, which make no sense whatsoever. The ability to amortize and take massive deductions if you own real estate as opposed to a different type of asset. Why? Because they figured out how to game the system. Is that good for the average American? Of course it's not. But let's not pretend that that's about a small number of politicians that are actually sold out to interests outside the United States. No, no, no. We did this to ourselves. This is about what's happening inside the United States.
So just to make the point really clear, you're basically saying this straw man of, let's say, center left, center right neoliberal politicians waking up in the 1990s and saying, my number one job is to help the Bangladeshi over the local Ohioan, is not true. Is that a way of basically articulating it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's insanity to think that's true. I mean, like, who would these people be?
Not to make you seem old, but just tell us about the 90s. How did you see that debate playing out?
Look, I mean, the fact is that you make a lot more, things are much more efficient in a global economy when you are taking advantage of global markets. So Americans like buying cheap stuff over expensive stuff if it's the same good. And the fact that the Chinese happen to have the largest pool of inexpensive, hardworking labor meant that a lot of American companies ended up pulling up their stakes and moving their production to China. That's not happening anymore because Chinese labor is now much more expensive and because of automation and robotics and deep learning and AI. So you just don't need as much labor as you used to, not to mention the fact that the Chinese have their own big corporations and they don't have rule of law. So there's a lot of fighting and competition that happens there. But the point is these companies were making an immense amount of money, but their tax rates were generally quite low. And there was no redistribution that was happening inside the United States that would lead to improve the social contract. So the country is growing at a strong clip. The rich are getting far richer in the United States. They like that. Meanwhile, who's taking care of the average American worker? The fact is that for some 40 plus years from the 70s through the 90s, the go-go 90s, through the aughts and the noughts and the 2010s, the teens, you basically had flat wages for the average member of the American working and middle class. And you had a massive explosion of the top 10%, 1%, and particularly the 0.1 and the 0.01%. And those are the people that happen to have the most ability to influence and capture regulatory policy in the US. The United States is the country in the world that is most driven by animal spirits. We most revere entrepreneurialism. And so, I mean, look, that's how I managed to create a company in the US that became a global company from scratch. No outside investment. I have 200 full-time employees. You wouldn't do that easily in any other country in the world. It's why we have Bezos. It's why we have Gates. It's why we have Elon Musk. This is not coincidence. But if you revere those animal spirits and you ignore all of the people that are otherwise living in your society, you will piss those people off. And they will eventually vote for people that are prepared to break things. And that's what's happened in the United States.
And that basically takes us back to the crisis issue. I hate just pulling from the start of a book, but it's a useful anecdote to talk about. Can you tell everyone the story of Gorbachev, Reagan, and aliens? I've got a couple questions about that.
Sure. I thought it was the right story to begin with.
As a podcaster, it's a lazy trope to be like, hey, here's the first sentence of the book. Tell me about it.
Yeah. But in a book where I'm saying that even when the left and the right in the US hate each other And even when the Americans and the Chinese hate each other, that we can still actually pull together to respond to crisis and make a difference. Well, the definitive moment in my kind of growing up was all about the Cold War. It was this, the Americans facing off against what Reagan called the evil empire. And then he meets with Gorbachev for the first time in a dacha outside of Geneva. And only the two men and their translators are there. So the story doesn't even come out for decades afterwards. No one knew about it. And Reagan goes to Gorbachev and said, so if we were attacked by aliens, you'd come to our aid, wouldn't you? And Gorbachev said, of course. I think Gorbachev was a little surprised by the question. And Reagan said, well, I would too. We would too. And it actually is not just an icebreaker, but ends up creating a moment of trust between these two men, these two incredibly powerful men, that leads to very productive arms control talks, actually changing the trajectory between the relationship of these two countries that were pointing thousands of nuclear warheads at each other, threatening Armageddon. And of course, also helped to facilitate trust when Gorbachev started unwinding what was the Soviet Union through systemic political and economic reforms. I would argue that we're facing equal levels of dysfunction today at the global level and, you know, frankly, greater level of dysfunction at the domestic level in the United States. But it's precisely these crises that are going to force us to see each other once again as human beings and will allow us to become, you know, sort of our better selves.
And, you know, I'm curious, I'd like to know your answer to the, would we, let's say in 84, have fought with the Soviet Union against aliens question.
What do you mean, would we?
Would we have fought together against aliens?
If with the Soviets?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course we would have. And we would today. Absolutely.
See, and this is where I want to push you on this, because I don't know how much of a science fiction fan you are, but
I am.
If you think about in most of these sci-fi invasion scenarios, like let's say you're talking like Ender's Game, or you're talking, you know, situations where there's aliens invading, it's very like it's very binary, right? The aliens are coming and the aliens are going to kill you.
Yeah.
But part of the trope, though, is this idea that usually there's like a communication problem. So if it's like Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, the ancient spaceship that's destroying the Earth because the whales aren't there isn't actually communicating. But I guess what I want to wonder is, and this, let me ramble for a quick second to make set this
up. The contact was cool, right? Because that was all about figuring out how to communicate with the aliens. Independence Day, they didn't communicate, but we all came together. That was a stupid one, but Reagan would have loved it. You know.
But that's the key part of the dynamic, though, which is what I want to wonder is, what if, let's say the Star Trek one, the ancient whale defending ship said to the Earth, hey, our beef is actually only with the Japanese. Because it turns out the Japanese we talked to Greenpeace. They're doing most of the attacking. Also, assume you don't have like the Deus Ex Machina of, you know, the Enterprise being able to go back in time. So Earth is going to lose. But the aliens say, look, we're going to destroy Japan, but, you know, trust us or not, we're going to leave the rest of you alone, or you unite together and fight us. What I'm basically trying to get at is, it seems that the problem with the alien metaphor for me is it presents zero trade-offs, and it presents either or. And the toughest crises that you're describing in the book are ones, like you said, with COVID, where there's actually a trade-off, where there's a debate of, okay, do I care about order or do I care about liberty? How high do I prioritize freedom? How many people am I willing to have die? The answer is 1.5 million. You know, I have family members who aren't vaccinated. They're not fine with it, but it didn't reach their threshold. But there's an actual trade-off. And in the alien scenario, there aren't trade-offs. So what I was basically trying to get out of the Japan example is this idea of, like, would we actually unite together if there were a deal on the table? How do you think about this?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the reason why this is a useful analogy in the book is because the conversation actually happened and the two men in question actually saw it that way, which is interesting. So I'm glad you weren't in the room with them, because it would have screwed the whole damn thing up.
Yes.
leaving that aside, I would argue that COVID and climate change and disruptive technologies that we haven't talked about yet and the Russia invasion of Ukraine are actually all crises that do not present a deal for individual leaders to cut and be better off. In fact, I mean, the climate's a great example because climate's one where we were ignoring it longer than the Chinese. The Chinese are investing in all of this solar and wind and lithium supply chain, cobalt. And suddenly we look around and we go, wait a second. These guys are going to dominate the post-oil energy environment unless we start investing in this stuff too. So in fact, it's even better than the scenario I just suggested, because even in an environment of competition, it's a virtuous competition. It's a competition towards recognizing that the planet is just going to be so much worse off unless we do this stuff and we do it fast. Now, I mean, with COVID, there's no question that we had vaccines and we were not willing to get those vaccines to other countries until we got the vaccines ourselves. I get that. That's a level of like national selfishness. Like we bought them for a lot of money. It was Operation Warp Speed. Trump got it done. And so we're not going to send it to some shithole country, as he'd call it, until we get those vaccines ourselves. Even if we're not going to take them, we're at least going to have the option of taking them. Right. But it is very clear that spending billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars in infrastructure to get those vaccines in the arms of sub-Saharan Africans and Indians, as soon as we had them at scale, would have saved trillions of dollars globally. In the United States, would have made it so much easier for so many people to get back to normal lives more quickly. And we just didn't think it was worth it. It wasn't urgent. We couldn't be bothered. It wasn't a big enough deal. But the basic structure of positive sum cooperation globally was absolutely there. And the Ukraine thing is also very similar. You have a whole bunch of people saying, why do we care about Ukraine? You know, you Europeans and Americans, you only care about them because they're white people. You didn't care about them when they were Syrians or when they're Yemenis or when they're Afghanis. Why are you caring about them now? Well, the fact of the matter is that the poorest people on the planet are going to suffer so much worse because of this Russia-Ukraine crisis, because they're not going to have food, right? And so the world, this is one where the world needs to come together more effectively, or everyone is going to suffer so much worse. It is utterly clear. So we are, I mean, it is interesting that we're confronting these kind of big global crises right now that are virtuous, that do have this Goldilocks crisis aspect. I'll give you a crisis that obviously doesn't have that, which is Buffalo, New York, right? I mean, we're not even talking about Buffalo anymore because now we got the school that got shot up in Texas. But I mean, you got this white nationalist crazy kid that is like bored out of his skull during the pandemic. He's gunned up like crazy. He finds an all black neighborhood. He drives over there, he scouts it out. And then he shoots to kill as many people as he can. And what are we going to do about it? Nothing. Why not? Because it doesn't affect all of us. We just don't care. And that is, I mean, so we'll say a lot of stuff, but we won't do anything. That is a crisis where we can cut a deal. It's not a global crisis, not a national crisis. It kills me that that's the case, but that's a different kind of story. And as a consequence, I don't write about that in the book.
So something I'm curious about then is you very specifically, this gets to something you write in the book. You're referring to competition with China, which is a loaded word in terms of the debate that's playing out right now. You very concertedly argue that you are in favor of trying to pull us away from this path to a Cold War, which yes, suggests we are not in a Cold War right now. We're in a state of competition. Could you explain that scenario? Because I think to a lot of listeners, they woke up on Monday to a New York Times notification, which I certainly did, saying President Biden has explicitly said we would defend Taiwan. That is clearly it's a policy I support, but those are fighting words, at least in terms of how the CCP has articulated it. Why aren't we in the Cold War now then?
Well, first, it's the third time he's said it. We have a policy of strategic ambiguity towards China where the Americans are willing to provide all the support so the Taiwanese can defend themselves, but not directly defend Taiwan. So not send boots on the ground, not do a no-fly zone, similar to the way that Biden's articulated the Ukraine policy, for example. And then every time he said that, then the White House within a couple of hours has said, no, 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 we still have the same policy of strategic ambiguity. And the Chinese, you know, say they're angry, but they don't really do anything about it. Part of this is that Biden is 79 and he doesn't really like get the distinction between defending a country and putting boots on the ground in a country. And strategic ambiguity is not something that he's been willing to like spend the time to articulate accurately. He's been pushed, they've pushed him back in the White House and said, here's the way you should talk about it. He just doesn't talk about it that way. And I think the Chinese kind of get it. The Americans kind of get it. I mean, you know, for example, we just announced, the US just announced the Indo-Pacific economic framework, and Taiwan wanted to be a part of that framework. But the Biden administration didn't make them a part of that framework. That would have been a much more directly hostile move to make that would have set the Chinese off. Biden had every ability to make that decision. He didn't do it. Why not? Because he's not actually changing US policy towards Taiwan. So, I mean, look, there is this, you're right. Every time Biden misspeaks and the White House pulls it back, just like Biden did. Biden did this in Poland. At the end of his speech in Warsaw, he said, my God, we cannot let this man stay in power. He just wrote an op-ed in The New York Times a few days ago where he explicitly says that U.S. policy in Russia is not about regime change. But the former is a wonderful soundbite, especially for people that don't like Biden in a very divided policy environment. So, of course, you're going to use it and you're going to play it relentlessly and you're going to beat him up, just like the Dems would when Trump misspoke all the time. I get the game. I don't, it's not something I'm proud of, but I get why people do it. When you ask me what the US-China relationship actually is, and by the way, I don't have any, the fact you said, Marshall, that you're in favor of a policy where the US would defend Taiwan, frankly, I think I lean towards you on that one. Taiwan's kind of, they're a democracy, and I don't like the fact that the Chinese just abrogated their Hong Kong agreement on the political right of the Hong Kong Chinese to continue to determine their own form of government. I think that the Americans leaning in and creating a little bit more ambiguity around American response in Taiwan is a useful thing. I don't have a problem, frankly, even with Taiwan. If Biden had intentionally misspoken, I think I'd be okay with that, frankly. But that's not my point. My point is that the United States and China are the two largest economies in the world, and they are incredibly interdependent on each other. The Americans buy an enormous amount of goods from China. American universities accept all these Chinese students that pay full freight. Chinese tourism is the most important US tourism that is accepted in terms of dollars. Massive amount of Chinese investment into US treasuries. US corporations across the board do a lot of business in China. And those that have national security implications have largely been decoupled, but most are not. Most are doing more business with China. Most are like the NBA. Most are like Disney. Disney's having bigger problems in Florida right now than they're having in China, frankly. That is the reality. And so I think that we should recognize that a Cold War is not one where you are leaning into the interdependence between the two countries. A Cold War is one where you are trying to decouple as fast as possible and you see the relationship as zero sum. The actual relationship when the US and China is much more analogous to a marriage where you and your husband or wife no longer really love each other, but you have children that you love deeply and they're young and they're in the house and you're both raising them. And as a consequence, you're going to continue to act as a functional family because you both care deeply about the kids. That's the nature of the US-China relationship today. And that's why it's not a Cold War.
You know, this isn't a contradiction in the way you frame this, but it's a complicating dynamic. Mm-hmm. You call for, let's say, a green Marshall Plan, you know, green New Deal, all these different things. When we're talking about the Marshall Plan, we're obviously referring to rebuilding Europe after World War II, but yep. That wasn't argued purely from the goodness of our, you know, liberal internationalist hearts. Like that was argued from a very pragmatic, this is how we're going to shore up Western Europe against the Soviets. Without the backdrop of a Cold War with China, how can we take the energy and do those Marshall plans, do those bigger bits?
Well, you're kind of getting at the entire point of the book, which is that absent a clarion call, absent a crisis that forces us to act, what you will see is institutions and nations that are adrift. You won't see that behavior at all. But what I'm arguing is you don't need the common enemy of a country. You can actually respond to the common enemy of a crisis. And climate change is that crisis. I mean, there are others, but there's no question. When you see the damage that is being done to your home and your community and mine, that moves you. Now, if climate change were something that were only affecting lesser developed countries around the world, and if we had a credible plan in the United States that could allow us to literally avoid that, build the wall and separate us off, you want to talk about science fiction, right? I mean, what about all those science fiction movies where the small percentage of people decide to get off the failing planet and they say, we don't care anymore. Look, Elon Musk talks about that. He says, we gotta build something on Mars because we're going to destroy our planet. Nobody credible really buys that solution. Most people are like Bill Gates, though a lot less wealthy, who say, we're on this planet. It's an amazing planet. We're not making another one. We're going to have to like fix it. And that, I think, provides massive motivation for us to do things. Keep in mind, the United States is still the wealthiest country in the world. We are the most powerful. Our military, we spend more in the military than the next 8 countries combined. We have the global reserve currency in the US dollar, which allows us to weaponize it and force other countries to do what we want or else. Our banks are the strongest. We're an energy exporter. We are a food exporter. We have the best higher education. There are so many ways that the United States is the biggest and most powerful country in the world. And what that means is when you have a big global challenge that affects everyone, we are the ones that will get hurt the most if we neglect it. And we are the ones that will benefit the most if we respond effectively, if we lead an effective response. And by the way, coming out of World War II, took us a while to get into World War II. That's where America first started. It was like, why do we bother? It's happening over there. A lot of Europeans are dying, but it's not Americans. So who cares if it's a threat to democracy? Who really cares about the Nazis? Not a big deal. It was only when the Japanese attacked us that we decided we were going to get involved. But coming out of World War II, you know, we recognized that if we didn't rebuild Europe, we were the ones that were going to suffer the most because we were the country that emerged from World War II standing. Well, I mean, we're the country in 2022 that has the most to gain or lose from taking a leadership role. So it's actually in our not even enlightened self-interest, just our self-interest. It's in our, even if we didn't care about other countries around the world, I do, but even if we didn't, you could make this argument. The reason J.D. Vance won't make this argument is because the American political system is way too short-term. And so the answers in the United States are going to come mostly from people that aren't regular political actors. It's going to come more from longer term governors and mayors than it's going to come from members of the House and senators. It's going to come more from bankers and CEOs and from individual influencers than it's going to come from our political leadership in Washington. I think that is an unfortunate reality of the political time that we're in.
Wait, but what does that look like? So, you know, the Conference of Mayors, I forget the name of all these different conferences, but there's like the national like governance organization for mayors in the country. They've made all sorts of declarations on climate change.
Yeah.
And I don't see any way of it. The status quo has been at all affected by those declarations. Can you just articulate what that means?
Sure.
So two
things. First, that when Trump became president, one of the first things he did is he pulled the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. And everyone thought that was going to be a disaster. It wasn't a disaster. And it's because a large group of mayors and governors and CEOs and bankers and Mike Bloomberg and others said that we are still going to stick with our commitments under Paris, even though Trump pulled us out. And so you lost no momentum on America's efforts to decarbonize and its net zero commitments and the move to invest trillions of dollars into renewables and away from fossil fuels, despite the fact that you had one of the very few people that could become president that was kind of a nearly overt climate denier. I think that's a pretty big deal. Now, you're right. Mayors by themselves, if they have to do all the driving, they're going to make a statement in a group of mayors, not going to make much of a difference. But actually, when you think about how much has changed in where investments have been oriented and where the world's energy mix is coming from, you would say it's mostly not come from Washington, those changes. It's mostly come from outside of Washington. It's come from a whole bunch of other actors, and it's a constellation of those actors. What's one of the things that's most exciting and hopeful from the book is that increasingly the world is becoming post-Westphalian. In other words, it's not just about central governments. So Russia invades Ukraine on February 24th, except they didn't.
Could you explain the idea of Westphalian?
Yeah, Westphalian just means that the actors that matter the most, that drive all of the outcomes, are central governments. That is this Westphalian system of international politics, that if you are not in power in a national government, you don't matter very much. And what we're seeing is that, like, in responding to the pandemic, the most important actors arguably were the Moderna and the Pfizer folks. In responding to climate, the most important actors were Eurocrats in Brussels, were bankers on Wall Street, were mayors and governors in the United States. I mean, California and Texas have done a hell of a lot more to drive America's response on climate than anything coming out of Washington. I mean, that's very clear. Climate standards in California have moved so much, and renewable investments in Texas have moved so much, red state and blue state. It's interesting that Russians invaded Ukraine. The invasion really started on the 23rd, which was a cyber attack, massive cyber attacks against Ukraine. The Ukrainians didn't even know about it, but Microsoft did. So in other words, the first attacks weren't really Kiev. They were actually Redmond, Washington. That was where the war started. And the extraordinary support that was provided by Google and Microsoft and SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, for the Ukrainians the last 3 months, every bit as important for their still having a government in place as what we've seen coming from the United States and Germany and France and the NATO allies. So if you want to talk about how we're responding to the Russian invasion of Ukraine and this new Cold War with Russia, you wouldn't just talk about governments. You talk about tech companies on the cyber side. That's really interesting, right? Because then you don't have to worry about, you know, only is our government broken. There are other opportunities. There's opportunities for dystopian dysfunction, but there's also other opportunities for solutions. And we see that in climate change. We see it with the pandemic. We see it with disruptive technologies. We see it with the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
You know, in these last 10 minutes, I want to get to disruptive technologies, but I have a quick follow-up. You just articulated this whole decentralized governance model. I think in the best faith way possible. I definitely do know there are listeners who think that what you've described is quite hellish, because what you're basically describing is a situation where corporate power, private organizations, actors outside of public accountability are going to have the ability to drive massive decision-making things without any ability to intersect there. And I think to you bringing up, you know, DeSantis and Disney, obviously let's put aside the like culture war bullshit part of that. At a core level, is that's the state versus a corporate actor. And I did notice a bit of tension, especially even on the left, behind what was basically going on. People were saying, man, I feel uncomfortable defending the ability for Disney to run a private town, essentially. So what do you say to people who can agree with the direction you're taking it, but feel uncomfortable about the power of these non-democratic actors?
Well, that what I've been writing about, not just this book, but you mentioned Us Versus Them before, and what I've been writing about for the last 15 years has been about institutions that are increasingly not aligned with power. Like when we created NATO and we created the UN and the World Trade Organization, it was at a time where you build those institutions and the governments that build them to reflect their interests, their balance of power, their priorities. Over time, the balance of power changes. Corporations become more powerful. Tech sector becomes, you know, really strong. China rises. Right? All this stuff happens, but the institutions don't change. Now, when that happens, you get what I call a geopolitical recession. The institutions start to erode. They become obsolete. They break. They become delegitimized because they're sticky, right? I mean, it's like Russia has a permanent seat in the Security Council. Germany and Japan can't get on. Why? Well, because Russia won World War II and Germany and Japan lost. That's a really stupid reason in 2022, right? You'd want to do something about that, but you can't. So you're identifying the fact that it's really bad when new actors have all this power, but there are no institutions around them that would regulate them, that would provide oversight. I mean, Twitter can take Trump off of their social platform. And maybe you like that, maybe you hate that, but should they be in a position to make that decision by themselves? That seems like too much power for one random CEO. And then if Elon Musk buys it, then he gets to completely change the course of American politics. That doesn't seem like something we'd want him to do, right? You'd want oversight. You want something. So what that means is that it's not enough for these crises to simply be resolved. You have to use the crises to create new architecture, new institutions. You recognize that the old institutions are broken and you change them. So, you know, for example, NATO, where we're bringing in Finland and Sweden. But what about Asia? I mean, this is an opportunity for advanced industrial democracies to all come together. I think it's interesting that the Asian allies are being invited to the Madrid summit at the end of June. For the last years, we've all heard about the pivot to Asia, that if America pivots to Asia, it doesn't care about Europe anymore, doesn't care about the Middle East. Maybe we can stop talking about that. Maybe you could actually create architecture where the United States works with its allies around the world. And it's not Europe or Asia, but they come together. Well, how might you respond to these corporations doing things that are essential for governance, but that we wouldn't want them to have no oversight whatsoever, only to their shareholders? You're going to need to create the institutions and the architecture that will allow for checks and balances on the decisions that these corporations are going to be making. That's the way institutions get made. But usually to make institutions like that, some things have to break first. And what we see happening right now in the world is some things are breaking first.
Does nature abhor a institutional vacuum? So like if these institutions, yes.
And it's okay. In other words, what I'm trying to argue here is this isn't because we have bad leaders. This is not because we hate Trump or we hate Biden. This is because the institutions that we have now are falling apart because they don't reflect the world order anymore. Like if you bought a car, you get a tune-up, you get the oil checked, but over time, your car stops working and you buy a new car. You don't say, I'm not going to drive anymore. I'm going to walk going forward. You know, you still need a car. It's just going to be a new car. Well, that happens globally too. And we're at a point where we need a new car. And it's okay to say that. And that's not the fault of the driver. Maybe we drove it a little too hard, you know, but actually the car is supposed to eventually break down because the world is so different. By the way, Trump, one of the things Trump did that I liked the most was when he got rid of NAFTA and he created the US-Mexico-Canada agreement. And he did it in his own bullying way. But the fact was that NAFTA was a great institution when it was set up. But by the time Trump was president, it was less than 50% of trade between the US and Mexico and Canada. And the reason for that is because a lot of our trade is now about data and services. But when we signed NAFTA, data and services weren't a thing in the relationship. But nobody changed NAFTA. So, and I like the fact that the new US-Mexico-Canada agreement literally has forced obsolescence, that in 10 years it has to be voted on again to be either recreated or it will die. So there's an action forcing event that makes us reform it. And by the way, the bureaucrats hated that. They said, no, it's so much work to do this. We shouldn't have a closing window on it. We should just make it permanent. No, don't make institutions permanent. It's the worst thing you could do because the world will change and you need flexibility in your institutions.
You know, we're nearing time here, but I know everyone's screaming, what does Ian think about NATO? Because I know in, you know, Superpower 2015, you spoke specifically about how, or wrote specifically that NATO expansion of the 1990s was a mistake. We're here now, but how do you think about this permanence? Because this was also another institution that Trump very aggressively went after. Obviously, the difference is, unlike with, you know, NAFTA, Trump didn't attempt to reform it. He just was like, I want to leave. That didn't go anywhere.
Well, NATO was, expansion was a mistake in the sense that it either went too far or not far enough. I could make both arguments. It went too far in the sense that you offered this candidate membership status to Ukraine and Georgia without having any intention of bringing them in. And it was, you know, kind of a screw you to the Russians, but they didn't have the institutional basis to join. And frankly, there wasn't the support inside Europe to get them to join. And that created more instability, not less. You could also argue that it was too little in the sense that the EU expanded and NATO expanded, but you never had a real interest in bringing the Russians in. There was no Marshall Plan for Russia. They were the ones that were humiliated by the loss of their empire. They screwed up and they got shock therapy from the United States, but they didn't really get the support to build and integrate into Western institutions, which was the big opportunity. And we didn't take it very seriously. And we had many bites at that apple. We never really did it. So either way you go, you could say NATO went too far. You could say it didn't go far enough. But either way, it wasn't reflecting the changed circumstances of Soviet collapse. And also wasn't reflecting changed circumstances of the rise of China, becoming the most important strategic interest of the US is dealing with the rise of China. But NATO refused to actually focus on China. And they refused to really engage with the Japanese and the Australians. No, it's a North Atlantic treaty and we can't do that. I would argue that that was a mistake. Cyber, they were really taking their time on cyber. Technology companies are critical on cyber, but they're not really involved very much in NATO. Does that make a lot of sense? NATO can't do this stuff by themselves. The SolarWinds attack, most important attack on the United States and its allies in the last 5 years, the governments didn't find out. The private sector found out, right? FireEye, they found out. So you have to adapt the institution to a changing reality, a changing geographic and geopolitical reality, a changing technological reality in the balance of forces and what it means to have national security. And none of that was going to happen absent a crisis. Smart people have been bringing this stuff up for the last 10 years. I mean, I've brought it up, but I've seen other people do it too. They just talk to the hand because it's not a priority. It's not a crisis. So when you're in an environment that the institutions are eroding as badly as they have, you actually, it's not that you want a crisis because a crisis causes a lot of damage, but you do need one. And we now have them. So this book is kind of after 10, 15 years of writing the end of the free market and every nation for itself and us versus them, all these books that have described the unwind of the global order and the move towards a G0 and the reality of an impending geopolitical recession. This is the book that talks about, okay, in this crisis-rich environment, what are the seeds for the next global order and how are we going to take advantage of that?
Ian, this has been really great. Thank you so much for joining us on The Realignment.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.